Please, if you have any questions, put your hand up and I'll run around with the mic to come to you for questions. Don't be shy because this is a very rare opportunity, as Aya has mentioned this morning. And yeah, don't be shy with all your questions. Please come up. Oh, we already have one. Great.
Sorry, we do have someone online that popped in first.
Okay.
So just in terms of timing. But Ajahn, thank you again. This is very interesting for Q&A. Yesterday was fantastic. No one wanted to leave. And so let's start, shall we? We've got the first question online and then we'll come to the person who put their hand up over here. Also, we had some people ask us during the break if they could ask for live audience anonymously. You can do that. We do have some pieces of paper here and pens, so you could just write your question in and pass them over to our volunteers and they will come over and give it to me. And for those who are online, if you want to ask your questions, just pop it into the chat. And if you like to keep it anonymous, just send it to Meta Center staff and then they'll be able to share it with me. So Ajahn, first question.
Yes.
Warmest greetings, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you for saving my life with your Dharma talks on YouTube. I would like to, in part, express gratitude by memorizing in English the Ratana Sutta with your blessing of filling in the following blank.
It's a test. It's a test.
The pure stillness the Supreme Buddha praised is described as blank. What would you like me to call it? May you be happy and well everywhere, always. Thank you for being kind.
I like the word blank. For example, when you come into this room, what do you see? Most people come here, they see other people, they see seats, they see the stage up here, they see Buddha statue. How many of you, when you come into this room, see what's between the ceiling and the seats? What's between the walls? And the majority of what's in this room is emptiness, it's space. And sometimes we always look at things. We want to give a name to something, but I don't like names. Because when it's a name, it kind of defines it, it puts it in a prison of a name. It's much nicer just to call it blank. Because when it's really blank, that emptiness, that space, that's of nothingness, is much more freedom, much more peace. How many of you, when you're meditating, keep thinking about things, trying to give it a name, trying to see the result of things? Uh-oh, have I said something wrong? Okay, and there's a security out there. So you can always ask them to take me away. Okay, I prefer the blank. Emptiness, nothingness, freedom. And always do that when you come into a like a room or a hall. Don't just look at the things in here. Look at the things which are between us. Sometimes people think that's what separates us. To me, I say, no, that's what connects us. Even just when launched conferences overseas, and they put some little messages in the ocean, say the oceans separate us. They don't separate us. It's the oceans which connect our lands together. Just a different way of looking at things, but something which is far more beautiful. So I prefer blank.
Beautiful answer. Thank you so much, Ajahn. Okay, now Sophia's going to take us to the next live audience who has a question.
Hi, Andrew and Bram. I've been following you for many years now, so thanks so much. You've changed my life.
For the better or for the worse? I always ask that.
It's good to be clear. I've been practicing meditation for a while and also through your guided meditation sessions. And I think I can see slow progress, especially when you look back over 10 years, 15 years. But it's also quite frustrating sometimes how slow it is. Retreats are not something that's in my life phase a
Yes.
possibility on a regular basis. So I just wonder if you've got any tips for practicing at home and making it stick.
Okay, practicing at home. Make sure that in your apartment, in your house, if you've got a house, you have a room set aside for meditation. There was this one family over in Perth, and they, when they got a new house, they had two kids, and they did the cupboard under the stairs, and that was their holy room. And they would go in there to meditate together, and they would always tell their children that the children were too young, they weren't allowed to go in there to play. It was just the mum and dad's little place to meditate. And then what happened, when the daughter was about 3 or 4, and their son was about 6, that they had a fight. It was the first time in her life the elder brother hit his younger sister. He just was, you know, getting angry. He regretted it enormously. But the little sister being hit by elder brother, she started crying. And where do you think she went? Into the meditation room. And she sat down there. She knew she wasn't supposed to go in there, but it was a place of quietness and safety and peace and love. And the parents, as soon as they saw her go in there, they'd just stay in there for a while, and then just gave her a big hug afterwards. Elder brother said, sorry, you just lost it. But that was a wonderful resource to have in a family, a little room where you can just go and just enjoy the peace and the safety and the happiness there. So for you, I don't know how big your place is where you live, but even if you live under one of the bridges in Sydney, those bridges are very big. You should be able to find a place there somewhere where you can just sit down and be peaceful. Once you have a place there, just respect it. Don't do anything else there except for meditating or just being peaceful. I don't think meditation is always just shutting your eyes and getting really still. Remember that meditation is, the path of meditation is learn to be at peace with things as they are right now. I haven't taught this yet. This is going to be, again, a bit long, but this is a beautiful type of meditation, which is what I call the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Have you heard me teach that before? The Emperor's Three Questions meditation is, number one, when is the most important time? Now, it's the only time we ever have. So when you sit down to meditate, don't ever think of what's happened before. Never think about where you're going to get to. Just, you know, what's happening right now? Number two, what's the most important meditation object? The one which is right in front of you right now, whatever it is. Whatever thought, whatever emotion, whatever, that's here now. It's right in front of you. Therefore, it's the most important in the whole world. The Emperor's Three Questions story, I think many of you would know. Who's the most important person in the world? Venerable Karthiko is, because he's right in front of me. Now he's not. Now I'm looking at Venerable Naroda. Whoever's right in front of you is the most important person in the world. I love that lovely insight. It means whoever you're talking to, you don't try and get rid of them. They are the most important person in the world for you. So then you can connect. And the last of the three questions, what's the most important thing to do? Which is to care, to be kind, however that kindness is. And that becomes the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Now is the most important time. What you're experiencing right now is the most important thing in the whole world. Give it importance. And the only thing to do with it is to be kind. Open the door of your heart to it. I know people say, look, if I open the door of my heart to it and it's really restless or it's very unpleasant, what do I do? Keep opening the door of your heart to it. Because remember, doors are to go in and doors are also to go out. And if you're kind to it, once you've learned the lesson from whatever you're experiencing, it leaves and you're at peace. Don't go meditating trying to get something or think what I'm experiencing right now is wrong or bad. Never think like that. What you're experiencing right in this very moment is important. Be kind. And after a while, what you're experiencing right now becomes incredibly peaceful and beautiful. And you find yourself getting into the deepest of meditations. I do that a lot. I don't just teach others. This is what I do. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn. Actually, yeah. I practice that if I work, when I see clients after clients after clients, and whoever comes in is the most important person to me. And it's amazing just how effective that is and how deep those conversations can go.
Excellent.
Here's all the questions from the audience here and more online. So perhaps I'll start with the one online. This actually is a question that was up yesterday, but we didn't have a chance to go to this question. There are many wars, conflicts happening around the world, neighbors fighting, human beings causing each other much suffering with fear of uncertainty, safety, anger over the death and attack on their friends, family, nation, and sadness and heartbreak over the death of many. Although there does not seem to have an end to wars, how might we face these conflicts within, externally, and both? How can we not see enemies? How can we not just see enemies, someone else's problems? Where is the Dhamma in all this?
Okay. A change of perspective. And that change of perspective, you may all know from Shakespeare, when he said all the world's a stage and all the people are actors on that stage. And we go through different roles in our existence. Sometimes we go through roles as soldiers, sailors, and our loved ones who lose their friends in wars and conflicts. Sometimes we have other tragedies in our life. And little by little, you know, we learn from these things. But then you say, but the wars and conflicts still go on. Yes, they do. But the actors, the participants in those tragedies, in those conflicts, in those dramas which are played out in our life, do change. Years ago I created this simile. Suppose there was aliens came down from a foreign planet and visited one of the schools here in Sydney. And they saw all the kids in the school learning mathematics or learning geography. And then they took all the notes. Then they went back to their planet and they came back 10 years later. And they went to the same school or a similar school. And they saw what looked like the same kids learning the same classes in mathematics and geography. And they would think, this is what those kids were doing 10 years ago. They haven't learned anything. They have learned. But those kids 10 years ago have graduated and gone to other classes, other places of learning. And they have been replaced by others. This is like the simile of this universe, or this planet Earth, especially part of this universe, being like a school. And people, you know, have to be playing the part of a prime minister, or playing the part of a soldier, playing the part of a business person, a poor person. And that's where we learn. And hopefully we don't have to repeat that role. Do it once, or if you're smart, don't do it at all. And just surpass what you did before. Don't think it's always the same. The conflicts are the same, but people involved keep changing. This is our world. And if you look in history, it's always been like this. It'd be wonderful if it wasn't. We have times, you know, when we have peace in our countries, peace in our regions. But when there's not that peace, we have what's called the opportunities to learn, to be better human beings by seeing the tragedies. You know, I was born after the Second World War, so I remember just all of the people I knew, my elders, teachers, these were all people who had seen their friends blown up. Even my grandmother told me that during that Second World War, they were in a small terraced house, only maybe about 4 or 5 meters wide. The neighbor got a direct hit from a bomb, and they were killed instantly. These were neighbors. In the place where my mother was sitting, her arm was lacerated with a flying glass. She survived, but they saw dead bodies, tragedies every day. And they always, we always see those people from Vietnam. We've seen that terrible Vietnam War. And they see just so many tragedies, but we learn from each one of those. And hopefully we learn the lesson always to be kind. I think I did tell that story of one of my favorite Vietnamese men. He was one of the refugees who came to Australia in a boat, just had nothing, just even a rag on his back, pretending to be a shirt. And when he came close to the West Australian coast, what did the two people who met him do? These were two Aussie fishermen. These two Aussie fishermen shouted out at him, "Welcome to Australia, mate! Have a beer!" Okay, forget the beer thing as a Buddhist monk. But nevertheless, that kindness, that welcoming, no questioning, just really just kept in his heart. And that was a gentleman, I think I mentioned the story earlier, who became the governor of South Australia for 2 terms. Later on in his life, he came in with absolutely nothing. He worked hard, built up a wonderful reputation, and was elected as the governor of South Australia. That's the sort of stories which I love, from starting with absolutely nothing. Even the shirt on his back was worth throwing away. But he had kindness. He was welcomed. And I always like that story when sometimes refugees come and we just ask them to, "No, we're already full, go away." Never do that. Okay, go on.
Okay, next question. So this is from someone in the live audience, but in writing. How do we make time to meditate when there are commitments and responsibilities that we can't afford and we can't avoid and take our time and mental resources?
Easy. At the very least, in the place where you work and you have to do all of that work and resources, aren't you allowed to go to the toilet when you need to? The thing is, in the United States, you've got to praise the United States for some things. One of the things, they don't call their toilets toilets. What do they call them? Rest rooms. So you can go to your toilet and tell your boss, "I'm just going to the restroom." And you go there for 20 minutes. And when you come out, why did you take so long in the restroom? Tell the truth. I was constipated. Up here. So that gives you the opportunity, you know, to at least take a few minutes of rest. And you do find out, this has been proven, that if you take a rest when you're really tight, tense, number one, afterwards your work is so much more efficient. You get 2 hours work done in an hour and a half. You actually make profit in your time. And also that when you go home, you're not such a pain in the butt for the people who live with you, like your kids. I don't know how many times Like women have come to my meditation class and they tell me, I didn't want to come this evening. I was tired, working hard. I just wanted to rest. My kids said, Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight? No, I'm too tired. Mummy, you must go to meditation. I don't feel like it. Mummy, go to meditation. Why, darling? The little kids said, because, Mummy, you're a much nicer mummy after you come back from meditation. The kids can see that straight away. So why not? Everybody wins. Your boss wins. You know, your family wins. The only people who lose out are the doctors and funeral directors. You get healthy.
You are, John. Now we're going to someone who's in the crowd. And for those who are here, please be patient. We do have a lot of questions to get through. We are getting through them. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Ajahn Brahan, the great teacher.
Over there. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. We have all the time, and we're trying to meditate. We're newie. The issue is that wife keep falling to sleep while doing meditation.
Very and good.
I cannot focus only because my mind wandering around.
Yeah.
So please advise.
Good advice. Number one, of the two of you, you have to praise your wife.
Sure.
And I say that. Because that's one of the stories I remember reading in the teachings of the Buddha. He was walking with his attendant, Ananda, and they came across a monk on the edge of the forest who was sitting perfectly straight. His posture was impeccable. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, I'm worried about him. And after a couple of weeks, he actually disrobed. But walking deeper into the forest, he saw another monk. He was nodding all over the place, really sleepy. And the Buddha smiled. So I'm not worried about him. In a couple of weeks' time, he was fully enlightened with many psychic powers. So watch out for your wife. But honestly, of those two, it is the most dangerous is the restlessness. The sleepiness, just let yourself be sleepy. You're tired. That's what the brain is like. And for such, who was it who was telling me a simile this morning? I kept on telling one of these nuns, which you know very well, I can't say who she is. Every time that I told her, if she was restless, just let go, relax, but I fall asleep. I'll fall asleep. Have you ever noticed there is no precept saying, I shall not fall asleep in meditation? Because what happens is when you fall asleep, it's because you're tired. You've been struggling too much. And your brain has been overworking. So if you could just relax it, yes, you may get tired. But when you get tired, you have enough mindfulness to know that tiredness. Leave it alone. Be kind to it. The tiredness is the most important thing in the whole world. It's right in front of you. It's right here. Be kind to it in this moment. And that's such an easy thing to notice. Yes, you're tired. But when you don't waste any energy you have, you're kind to your mind, then the mind wakes up and the back straightens. The first time that happened to me, just the back straightened up all by itself. I never gave the order, just watched it. Energy started to come back and the body did it. And then the mind was very clear. When I struggled to get rid of sleepiness, that's when I got restless too. It's either sleepy, restless, sleepy. I couldn't find that middle point. where you're perfectly aware, but not sleepy, not restless in between. And that's actually how it works. So calm down when your mind is restless all over the place. Allow yourself to fall asleep if your mind is tired. And then after a while, your mind wakes up and you have no restlessness, no sloth and torpor. And that's a beautiful state. From there, you can get some wonderful meditations.
Thank you. I have a few more questions, probably 10 more. Now I'm going to narrow down to two more questions, if I may.
Okay.
Okay. As mentioned, that we're kind of new to Buddhism.
Yes.
So when, we kind of heard about karma.
Our karma, yes.
Okay. In life, you accumulate good and bad karma. And good and bad karma in your life now.
Yes.
Are they transferable to your children?
No.
Okay.
You know, there's sometimes it's not just good or bad karma. Sometimes they're in between. You know, some parts of it is good, some parts of it is bad. And a lot of time it depends on, you know, how you respond to the things which happen to you in life. You've seen many, many people who have, say, an accident and they get disabled. There are people who get... I said this story as I was going in here, but I was only to a couple of people, about this tragic event of this guy. He was a painter, an artist, and he had a bad motorbike accident and he lost his hand, had to be amputated. And that was the hand with which he painted. That was not just his career, that was his love. You know, the part of life which gave him meaning to paint. And soon as he realized that, you know, now he'd lost his hand, he decided to commit suicide. That's how depressed he got. And so he climbed up, you know, in the elevator to one of these big high-rise buildings in Sydney. He stood on the edge, about to jump off to certain death. And then he saw on the ground this man with no arms at all, dancing up and down the street for joy. And he said, look, there's a guy who's got no arms. And he looks so happy. Why should I, just because I've lost one hand, feel so depressed? So he gave up the idea to jump off and commit suicide. He ran to the elevator, got down to the ground floor pretty quickly, and ran after this guy, gave him a big hug. You saved my life. You know, here I was, I just lost one hand, you've lost both arms. And I saw you dancing for joy. And that's when this man said, listen, I just told you this before, didn't I? You know what's coming. I love anticipation. He said, look, I'm not dancing up and down for joy. Oh, shut up.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm dancing up and down because I've got an itchy bum. That's the only way I can scratch it. You know who I am.
Ajahn Brahm, the great teacher. Yesterday, end of the first day talk, we went up there in the front and I had the real opportunity to take pictures with you.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that we went to Perth to see you in October 2020. And I asked a question, just out of curiosity, how you respond to it. Did you remember me? And straight away you say, yes, of course. That's why you're here today.
Yeah.
That's just fair. I mean, that's such amazing, a great leader.
Yeah. You know that I've got all these other tricks. Many of you come up to me and you say, Ajahn Brahm, do you remember me? If I said no, who the hell are you? That's rude. So the other trick I say is, yes, I remember you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting.
you save a lot of egos.
I'm going to use that next time, Ajahn.
I think your wife wanted to say something, did she? No, okay.
Perhaps another question from online?
Yes, go on.
Thank you. So the question here is, oh, and before I go to this question, I just want to let those in the audience know, we won't be bringing the mics to you anymore. So if you have any questions, please put it into the paper slips just so that we can save time because we've got a lot of questions to get through. Thank you for understanding. The next question online is this. Hello, Ajahn. I would like to ask, how do I stop suffering from attachment in all kinds of relationships in life?
Okay. Keep in the present moment. The person right in front of you right now. Those are the attachments which I have. When someone is talking to me, again, I don't know who you are. Sometimes I don't even remember your name. But when you're right in front of me, I kind of keep reminding myself you're the most important person in the whole world. And the most important thing for me to do is caring, which means listening to you. Not just listening with my ears, listening just the body smells, postures, how you're looking. And that gives a lot of information. And of course that's, I get attached to Dhamma. That's how you relate to people. Not just to one person, to so many people. And that's just how that kindness, when you can relate to people, and that's how it works. But I do also recognize, if you're in the family, there are some people who are really, really, really important to you. And especially like your children. Please never forget that. And that's what one of those other stories. I remember I was in Indonesia many years ago, invited onto a radio station for an interview. And the lady doing the interview was a Muslim girl. And when she asked a story about how to bring up children, that when I gave this story, she burst out crying. It was really sweet. Because I said, support this story about the father who came home late from work. And when he came home late from work, his son was waiting for him. Daddy, oh please leave it till later, son, I'm tired. Daddy, how much do you earn at work? Look, I don't know why a six-year-old wants to know that. Just go do something else. I just want to have a rest. But Daddy, how much do you earn at the office every hour? Look, I told you, son, I'm tired. Stop bothering me. But Daddy, how much do you earn? How many dollars every hour? I told you already, son. Leave me alone. I'm tired. Go to your room. You're grounded. So the little son, just asking a simple question, just trudged up to his room. And the father realized he'd done something wrong, but that's what we do when we're tired. And we forget what's really important in life. So after having a quick cup of coffee, he went out to his son's room and said, look, I apologize, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have shouted at you. I don't know why a child needs to know how much I earn at work. But just to let you know, I earn $20 an hour. And the son said, thank you, Daddy, and smiled. And then the son said, can I please borrow $10? And then the father was about to get angry again. But he said, no, once in the evening is enough. I'm not going to get angry at my son again. So the father took out his wallet and gave his son a $10 note. And his son smiled very sweetly at his daddy. Thank you so much, Daddy. And then the son reached in the drawer next to his bed and took out another $10 in coins, counted out a total of 20, gave it to his father and said, Daddy, can I now please have 1 hour of your time? I think a few of you got the message there. That Muslim radio personality, she just burst out crying, she couldn't speak. It was because she told me afterwards that her husband had run away. She was working for extra hard to raise her son, just the two of them, the mother and the son. And it was so difficult. But she too would come home late, tired, and wondering why her son and her weren't really connecting. That's all I want, Mummy, just 1 hour of your time. It's a story of our modern age. So please remember, you know, you gave birth to that kid. Or if you're a father, you know, you're involved. That's important, to spend time with them, and don't ever think that your son has to pay for that. How much do I owe you, Dad? 1 hour. So those sorts of attachments, I think that, you know, that's what you're buying into when you have a kid, and make sure you keep that responsibility. That makes sense?
It does. Thank you, Ajahn. Another question from the audience. How do you practice calmness throughout the day and to remain grounded and peaceful within? For example, imagining a very difficult term with various, or team, with various behaviours.
Okay. You know, when you see really crazy behaviour, weird behaviour, people just doing really stupid things. When Ajahn Chah saw me do behaviour like that, you know what he would do? He wouldn't get angry and upset. He would burst out laughing. One of those occasions was when, early days, I needed some soap, and all the requisites for the monks were kept in a big water jar next to Ajahn Chah's seat. So I had to ask for some soap. And I had to ask in Thai. The word for soap in Thai is sabu. I said sapo. Close enough. So I thought. And when I said sapo, Ajahn Chah looked at me. He was kind. He said, "What do you want sapo for?" Because sapo was short for pineapple. And I said, "To wash." And he never let me forget that. He said, "Oh, you know, in the West, especially over in Cambridge, in great university, they're far more advanced than we are in Thailand. You know, we use soap. Over in Cambridge, they use pineapple to wash." So whenever I did anything stupid, he would just laugh his head off. I think that's why he loved Western monks. We entertained him so much. You know the spittoons which we use, you know, in the monastery? You've got our bowl. We used to have a spittoon to put like fish bones or a banana peel or whatever else is left over there. And of course, Westerners who first go to those monasteries, they see the spittoons, and that's where they put their food in, and they eat from the spittoons. And that causes so much laughter. People like Ajahn Chah let them do that for entertainment. Anyway, I shouldn't go on like that. What's the next question?
Thank you, Ajahn. Next question is this. We always are so busy achieving something in this life. For example, when we are in primary school, we aim to go to secondary school, high school, university, work, get a partner, etc. At the end, we can't really own what we already achieve, whether it is these things, people, feelings, everything comes, stays and goes. Attaching with something that always changing, it's a dumb decision and makes us suffer. So what is the purpose of this life then?
To understand the reason why it's a waste of time. Look, that was something which really affected me when I was at university. Because when I was at primary school, I was really good at maths, but I liked playing soccer mostly. But then, you know, I still had to do the exams. I got a scholarship to a big high school in London. You know, it's only recently, you know, my primary school was a very poor school, mostly migrants. It's called Derwentwater School. And then from there you got a scholarship to Latimer School, which is, you know, quite a very prestigious school. And then later on, there was this actor's birthday, and he was quite famous, and he was featured on Google. He died just recently, and he had gone the same path from Derwentwater Primary School about 4 years before I went there, and then to Latimer School. His name was Alan Rickman, Dr. Snape in Harry Potter. So we did went the same path. Only I never became an actor. I was not scary. Was I scary? But anyway, so when I went to the high school, again, I loved playing soccer. I spent all the lunch hours and afternoons and evening playing soccer. And then sort of I started doing well at school, and my family, my teacher said, stop chasing a ball. Just stay at home, do your homework, and you do really well in life. Any one of you tell your children that? Don't. So I go out playing soccer. I see these days how much good soccer players get as a salary. Millions. Anyway, so I stopped chasing a ball, did my homework, and did really well at my O levels. And because I did the O levels, was I happy after you succeed in your O levels? No. Once you pass the O levels in the UK system, then you have to do A levels, more exams. And at that time, I wasn't chasing a football anymore. I was chasing girls. So my father had just died, and my teachers and uncles and aunties said, don't go out for too many parties. Stay at home, do your homework, because if you pass your A levels, then you'll be set, you'll be happy. So that's what I did. I followed their advice. It's wrong advice. I did so well in my A levels, they ended up going to university. More exams. And it was only when you went to university you started getting what I call suspicious. Everyone was saying, you're at a great university, pass your exams, get your degrees, and then you'll be happy. But this time I knew many people had already got their degrees. Were they happy? They were struggling getting a job. Even with a degree doesn't guarantee you a job. Once you've got a job, you've got to get a car, you've got to get a flat, an apartment. Again, you're still sort of chasing a partner in life, which is really expensive. And it's all so hard. Some of the people I knew had two jobs to try and pay off the debt for a car. Were they happy? No. I asked them, why not? Well, I said, when we can pay off the car debt, then we'll be happy. When we can get a nice apartment. How much are apartments in Sydney? It's incredibly expensive. So I really feel for the young people. But they think, okay, now we'll work hard, we'll just save up, and once we get an apartment, now then we'll be free, then we'll be happy. And then what happens? They find a nice partner in life, and that's really expensive, once it's two of you. And so they're never really ahead, but they work hard. When we actually save up enough and we can buy, even put down a mortgage, get in the housing market, then we'll be happy. And then usually what happens, they have a kid, then they're really in trouble. Was it 18 years or something before you can pay off all those debts? And then they think, oh, well, when my kid grows up, then I'll be happy. But by that time, you're getting old. And then you start thinking, yeah, okay, the children have left home now. We'll just work and save up enough money so we can retire. When I retire, then I'll be happy. But when you retire, by that time, you start getting weak knees, weak eyes, weak everything, which means, you know, you're getting old and the hospital bills go up. And that's why you find in Sydney, many old people go to Buddhist temples and mosques and churches. You know why? Because they think, when I die, then I'll be happy. That's why I got suspicious. It's always, I sacrifice this, I can be happy in the future. That's not good enough. But many of you come here, all you volunteers, you sacrificed a lot, not to get rid of today. When it's all over, then I can go back home and have a good rest. You enjoy it now. Don't think, I will sacrifice this moment because then I can be happy. You can sacrifice if you want right now and get the happiness right away. Always remember the good things which you are doing right now. Simple things right now. So don't go sacrificing thinking, I work hard and when I pass the exam then I'll be happy. Be happy right now, working hard. That's what I do. If I'm not enjoying it right now, there's something wrong. Even, so I got you just quick. Even, like going to the dentist. How many of you enjoy going to dentist? As a monk, it's the most comfortable thing to lie back in. So when I lie back in there, and number two, the dentist puts all these things in my mouth, and for once, I don't feel guilty about not answering questions. I can't answer a question. You're sitting back there just enjoying the beautiful, comfortable seat you lay down on. I always find something to enjoy. Okay. No, I won't do that to you again.
Next question. What should we do during times of despair and anxiety in the context of FOMO, fear of missing out, regarding the stuff your peers are getting and enjoying in life? Thanks.
Oh my goodness, it's great missing out. I've missed out on so much. I missed out on debts. I missed out on paying tax. I missed out on having a wife argue with me and keep me awake at night. I've missed out having kids. Actually, I haven't really missed out of having kids because, well, I shouldn't say this, should I? All the monks in my monastery, I look at them as my kids. They drive me crazy enough. I know what it's like. These are monks and nuns you've got to deal with. So, you can't miss out on everything. There's things which you have other people will never experience. And I always value those things. Like being a Buddhist monk. Have I missed out in life? I already mentioned to you of having baked beans from Mahinda Rajapaksa while he was president. But also some of the other people who I've met. Once I got this invitation, and when I opened it, I thought, wow, this is really a great invitation. This was an invitation to a state dinner in Parliament House in Canberra with Queen Elizabeth. It was during the Melbourne Commonwealth Games. And part of that was an invitation to a state dinner. Wow! But then I looked at the invitation, it was a problem. Dress code. It's true, I don't make this up. So I looked at it, the first item on the dress code, black tie. Now look, it's been years since I went to any formal dinners. I don't know what you do. What does a black tie mean? Is that all you have to wear? When the Queen is there. Just a black tie. I'm not going to go to a weirdo dinner where you just wear a black tie unless it's naked. And that's what they told me. This is like code. Black tie means a suit, white shirt, trousers, shoes. We don't have any of that in monastery. What was the second choice? Second choice was military uniform. I'm a pacifist. I wouldn't dress up as a general. And so they had the last choice, the third choice. When I saw that third choice, my eyes went wide. Yes, I can go. The third choice was long dress. Yeah, it counts. So I went wearing long dress. Security stopped me. They said, are you supposed to be here? And I had my invitation, yeah. And so they had to let me through. Have you ever had dinner with Queen Elizabeth? You better act fast for fear of missing out. That was good fun. I was with Ajahn Sujato. He was with me just afterwards at over here in Kirribilli House with a reception. And when we went in there, I always thought that someone like Ajahn Sujata was much more well informed. So, you know, Queen Elizabeth was there and Prince Philip, and then there's a few other people hanging around. There's this one guy hanging around. So, you know, he wasn't talking to anybody, so Ajahn Sujata and I went to chat to him. And my comment to him was, he was actually losing some hair. So I said, if you lose any more hair, you should become a monk like me and my friend. And Ajahn, he laughed. And Ajahn Sujata kind of laughed. You know Ajahn Sujata. And then afterwards he said, who was that? That's Prince Edward. What? Ajahn Brahm, you can't. Hundred years ago, I'd be put in the tower. You can ask him, you check him when you see him again, and what kind of go. Anyway, okay, better do another question.
Thank you, Ajahn. Actually, there's a movement against FOMO, which is JOMO, which is the joy of missing out.
Oh, that's much better, about. Yeah. Hmm. Excellent.
Next question. How do you manage a toxic and difficult personality in a family, especially if that family member is your own mother? How does karma work in this scenario?
I've heard that so many times. This was not quite your mother, but a mother-in-law. This Australian guy, he married a Vietnamese girl. She was very, very, very nice, but her mother-in-law hated her. She tried everything to make her mother-in-law respect her, and that caused so much trouble when your husband's mother says, why don't you marry somebody else? There's so many beautiful Australian girls. Why did you marry a Vietnamese? So she was in a very difficult situation. She was a Buddhist. She went to the temple and got lots of advice, did lots of loving kindness meditation, and nothing worked. But being a Vietnamese, she also went to a Mahayana Vietnamese temple. And when she was there meditating, chanting, trying anything to solve the problem, she kind of fell asleep at the temple. You know, that this is what happens. Sometimes you get tired, especially when you're worried. When she fell asleep, she saw this image of the Mahayana goddess Kuan Yin. And this Mahayana figure of Kuan Yin was coming right towards her in this kind of dream. And she was so excited, especially when she saw Kuan Yin's face. It wasn't a normal face of Kuan Yin. It was the face of her mother-in-law. And that was the end of the problem. Every time from that time on she saw her mother-in-law, it reminded her of Kuan Yin. and the relationship totally changed. So if it's your mother, see if you can sometimes look at her and change the image of the face to Aya Naroda. And when you see your mother-in-law, oh, she looks like just like Aya Naroda, and your relationship will change, guaranteed.
Oh, that's great advice, and yeah, Aya Naroda. We have a question online. How would one meditate on emptiness? We normally tend to have an object of meditation, but emptiness has no object, right? Thanks.
Yeah. So what do? You start the normal meditation, just relaxing your body, and then when you find some peace inside in this moment, then just allow the mind to be as empty as possible. It's like you go inside and things on the edges start to vanish, and keep going deeper inside and more things vanish until you're aware. But what you're aware of doesn't have any name. And when it gets even more empty of names and descriptions, you'll find you get closer and closer to emptiness. And when it really gets empty, because it doesn't hold any names, any responses, any emotional responses to you, it's like you're free. You're empty of all sicknesses and disease, all burdens, all sort of fears of the past. You are free. And that freedom always comes along with emptiness and gives you this natural bliss. It's like all the sufferings of life which you add on disappear. You're free of all these things. Okay, I'm going to go over time again. This is once when I was in Singapore, I was asked to give a session for some young people. It was close to Waysak Day. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. Sometimes I should ask what type of young people this is. This was kindergarten. Five-year-olds, six-year-olds. And how can you talk about Four Noble Truths or meditation to 5 or 6 year olds? And quite frankly, I thank you if you put me on the spot like that. So I said, okay, they had a Buddha statue somewhere, and I said, look, it's Waysak Day, I think tomorrow it was. Remember the story of Waysak? You know, we had the Buddha being born and taking 7 steps. And say, I am the chief in the world, this is my last life. That's the story. So I said, okay kids, line up, take 7 steps, and then put one, not that way around, the other way around, please. And they did that very easily, because kids can imagine, they need actions. Okay, number 2. The Buddha being enlightened. You see the pictures of the statues. So sit like the Buddha. So they sat like the Buddha and cross-legged, put their hands in their lap, close their eyes. Now imagine you're sitting under this beautiful Bodhi tree in this park called Bodh Gaya, close to the river. And imagine just how cool and peaceful it is. You can feel the winds just blowing gently over your body. And you've just become fully enlightened. You've got no more fears in the world, nothing you ever have to do. You're perfectly safe, nothing to worry about ever in the world. You're full of all the important knowledge. You don't have to struggle and strive anymore. Your health is just so good, and it will be good all your life. And I carried on like this. And the kids, they could understand it. They were imagining they were the Buddha. And so were the teachers. And so were the parents. They enjoyed it to the max, as some of you did. You can actually feel it when you imagine. Imagine what it's like to be fully enlightened. Imagine it. You've heard the stories so many times. Nothing to worry about in the whole world. Nothing missing from you or your life. No problems with health, with money, possessions. And so many trees, and any one of them will give you shade. So much food, people will give you food. You're an enlightened being. Feel what it must be like. And I never got to the last stage of enlightenment, you know, the parinirvana, because all the kids were enjoying it, and these were only 5 or 6 year olds. And how much more everyone else enjoyed it. And because of that, all the parents said, Ajahn Brahm, you're giving a talk tonight. Do that again to us. And it was very successful. You know, in Sri Lanka we call that Buddhanusati. But not just going itipi so, it's actually feeling what those words mean. No more burdens in this world. Totally free. You're not judged anymore. Any judgments don't mean anything to you. No health concerns, no worries. You're perfectly free of all attachments, free of all pains and sufferings, nothing more to do in your whole life or in any life. You're free. I better stop because I already get into that too.
Well, actually, Ajahn, the next question is related to that. The question is, how do I teach my autistic ADHD-er 8-year-old to practice 5 to 10 minutes of stillness?
You practice stillness and leave your kid alone. And you'll find if you can do it, your kid will sit next to you, silent. Children, have you, look, not children, like dogs. How many have got a dog at home? And when you meditate, you sit there quietly, your dog comes and sits right next to you and sits quietly too. The people you live with, the people you love, they pick up on what you're doing. And if you can sit down there quietly, a lot of times your kid does that too.
Good answer. Thank you, Ajahn. Next question. Venerable Ajahn, can you please give practical hints about how we can apply the knowledge that the self is created by one's thought, which is created by the 6 senses? Because the one who can excel in this practice can get rid of Sakyaditi in metta.
Yes. One of the ways which I found I can practice non-self so effectively, and you can see the benefits from it. Many years ago, now I would go into town on the weekend teaching, counseling, helping people with meditation. And then on Sunday evening I'd go back to monastery and pick up all the problems which happened on the weekend. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, work my butt off there. It was 2 jobs I was doing. And every now and again, you know, people like you would visit Bodhinyana Monastery and they say, what a beautiful monastery this is, how peaceful it is, you're so lucky to live in a place like this. And my response was, what? This is my workplace. I'm like the head gardener, the head counselor, I've got to make sure there's enough money in the bank to pay the bills. Not just my bills, other people's bills as well. And it was just such hard work. You know, I was the CEO of a couple of companies. And then I thought, hang on, something is very, very wrong there. You could see the beauty in Bodhinyana Monastery. I could not. That was my workplace. So I decided to change my attitude. Every Monday morning, I decided I would not be the abbot, the teacher of the monastery. If somebody came And they said, oh, can we see Ajahn Brahm? I said, he's not here today. It's my day off. If a monk said, oh, my meditation, I need some advice. Sorry, I'm not at work today. And for one day of the week, I had a day off. I wasn't responsible. I was not in charge of the monastery where I lived. And it was brilliant, because when I wasn't in charge, I wasn't looking at all the faults which needed to be fixed. I could look at that monastery like you do. Look, I ask you, those of you who are not going to the charity dinner this evening, those of you who go, say, to a restaurant tonight, when you go to a restaurant, will you wash the dishes afterwards? Will you tidy up afterwards? That's not your job, is it? Your job is just to eat the food and enjoy it, and then go home. When you don't take responsibility, you can enjoy the meal so much more. So when I took no responsibility on Monday morning, I could see that monastery like you see it, like a visitor sees it. And starting from that, I decided to be a visitor much more often. When I go to Santi Monastery or the Vihara, where I slept last night, that's not my Vihara, I don't own it. So if the and storms, if the windows leak and get water all over the floor, sorry, it's not my problem. I'm sorry, but that's true. If I go to Venerable Kaliko's monastery, the end of the world monastery, I haven't been there yet. One of these days I will. When I go there, sorry, it's not my problem. I'm only visiting. When you're just visiting, you can enjoy it so much more. So that's how I know I don't own things. When I visit my own cave in which I live, it's not my cave. I'm just visiting there. When I look at my body, which is getting old, I'm only visiting my body. I don't own it. So even this body, I take less responsibility every year. I'm just a visitor, not an owner. And then I start looking at my mind when I meditate. I do not own my meditation. That's such a wonderful insight to have. All of you talk about my meditation. Can you help with my meditation, Ajahn Brahm? It's not your meditation. Because of that, I mention this to many people, that I talk a lot about the very deep meditations, the jhanas. And so years ago, when I was giving some talks in Sri Lanka, there was all monks, and they asked me the question, Ajahn Brahm, can you achieve those jhanas which you keep writing about? And they said, I know that you usually use the excuse that a monk is not allowed to comment or claim these, what the Buddha calls superhuman experiences like jhanas or enlightenment. That if you lie, that's a parajika offense, most serious. If you even say the truth, that's a parjitya. But he said, there's only monks here now, so you can tell us the truth. So I told him the truth. I said to them, without any hesitation, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter a jhana. Now these were monks who knew me, so they realized there's something up with this. And I said, you know, the truth. And it's an important part of Dhamma. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear, first of all. Once I disappear, I don't own anything. I let go, because you don't own anything. Then those things happen naturally. You don't ever do them. You get out of the way and let them happen. And that was a beautiful piece of Dhamma. And that's actually totally accurate. If you try and own things, you create the sense of self. When you create that sense of self, you block things like these deep meditations, which are so empty, so peaceful, so blissful. And that is actually where those experiences of deep meditation and this teaching you've heard so many times of anatta, non-self, that's where they come together. That's how it works. And hopefully many of you will experience that. You vanish, you disappear, you're gone. You're gone, baby, gone. And you bliss your head off. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn. Next question. How do we deal with people that do not have good intentions for us? For example, who have jealousy or envy towards us?
If anyone has jealousy to me and they want to give the talk this afternoon, please! You're so kind! So, jealousy is the most stupid thing. I say the most stupid thing carefully, because the opposite of jealousy is what we call mudita. Mudita is when you enjoy other people's successes. When other people are happy, you can get a share in that happiness. I remember years ago being at Perth Airport when a group of Baha'is, you know, came in. These were refugees who had gone to so many different lands, they were persecuted, and they managed to get visas to come to Australia. And as soon as they came through that immigration barrier, the customs, they were in Australia, so much freedom here. They were up there punching the air and shouting for joy. They made it to a safe country. I was waiting for a monk to arrive, but I found myself also jumping in there and punching the air as well. I couldn't stop myself. That was mudita. Enjoying other people's joy, celebrating other people's successes. And I don't know why that cannot replace jealousy. Well done, you've made it, great, thank you, marvelous. So that's actually the opposite of jealousy. It'd be wonderful if we could actually give more talks about mudita, celebrating other people's successes in life.
You. Dear Ajahn, I live with a partner who is very angry all the time, never happy. According to the Buddha's teachings, should I keep being kind to him with the hope that one day he will be kind to me, or should I leave him and find my peace without hurting my inner self?
No, if that was me, I'd just be as kind as you can. Increase the intensity of your kindness. No one can resist it. I've never seen anybody able to resist wise, sustained kindness. They might as well give up now, because they're going to give up sooner or later. And it's a story again. This was, you know, sometimes when I was teaching in prisons, there they said, look, Ajahn Brahm, you live out there in that world. In prison, it's a very hard place. So, you know, there's some people you just cannot be kind to. And I said, what do you mean? Well, it's just some people, they just don't respond. I said, and that was a challenge. I said, okay, in this prison, which is the person you hate the most or is so difficult to you? Straight away he said, a senior prison officer. He never even acknowledges my existence. My job is to serve them tea and coffee in the administration building, and I'll get the best coffee I can for him, and he doesn't even acknowledge, doesn't say thank you, doesn't even know I exist. I put it down there, might as well be a robot. I said, this is excellent. So I said, from now on, I want you to do your loving kindness meditation specifically on this prison officer. When you make him a cup of coffee, find out what he likes the most. Find out what biscuits he likes. Find out what sandwiches he likes. Turn him on with your kindness. Really go intense. And every week I would go and check out, has a progress, hopeless. I really go so far trying to get something he really likes and he just totally ignores me. Carry on. It took 3 months to get the crack in the damn wall. He got him some tea, which he really liked, and put it on the table. Here's some tea, sir. I hope you like it. And the prison officer said, It was only a grunt, but that grunt went all around the prison. Not just one prison, it went on the prison grapevine, that this prison officer acknowledged this person existed. And I knew from that, I said, okay, you got the grunt, the whole damn wall is going to break soon. It took another month. The prisoner got this sandwich for him. Here's a nice cup of tea, sir. And here is a beautiful sandwich for you, sir. I hope you enjoy it. And the prison officer turned around and said, thank you. Now, that's a small thing for you. But in that prison system in Western Australia, because the prisoners get transferred from prison to prison, that went around all the prison system in Western Australia. And people couldn't believe it. But it happened. I won no bet there, but I won the wager, if you like. The kindness does work. If that is with, say, a husband, find out, when he does good behavior, he doesn't always do bad behavior. When he does grunt, acknowledging your existence or say thank you, do something you respect and like. Give him a wonderful hug and lots of kisses. Shower him with positive respect after he does something nice. When he does something just nasty, ignore him. Reinforce the positive. One lady, this is not recommended, okay? One lady was being domestically abused by her partner. No, hit physically. She never told us this. That's why I say, look, not recommended. This is what she did. Every time he hit her for no particular reason, she would not respond. Every time he was kind to her, she showed him how much she cared for that act of kindness. A big hug or a smile or something kind. She said it took her 7 years. But after 7 years, she had changed that man. And he became this wonderful husband. She brought him to Bodhinyana Monastery so I could talk with him. And she had one of these meditation cushions, not cushions, stools, made out of wood. And it was her birthday. He made her one, his wife, one of these stools, surprise. And she came and showed it to me. He said, 1 year ago, if he made anything out of wood, it'd be to hit me with. So now he's changed into a beautiful husband. And I was kind of proud of her. She'd actually won her happiness. She made it happen. And she changed this guy into being a lovely fella. I wouldn't try that because there's too many injuries. She was quite lucky. But it showed it can be done.
Thank you, Ajahn. And related to that question, is there a method to practice forgiveness?
Yes. the method to practice forgiveness. Too many people complain that forgiveness is just letting the person off the hook. So the example is of this couple. She was taking his suit to the dry cleaners. It needed a clean up. And she was just noticed some papers in the pocket. She looked at one of those papers. It was a receipt. A receipt for a local brothel. He'd been visiting prostitutes. And so she confronted her husband on this, and he admitted it. He said it was only once, and she just wanted to divorce him straight away. They used to come to Bodhinyana Monastery, so they came there to talk to me. She was so angry. And she says, look, I can't trust him any longer. The relationship's over. And he kept on saying, look, I still love her. I made a mistake. I'm sorry, please forgive me. And she refused to forgive him. So he had to find a compromise. And that compromise is called parole. I said, put him on parole for 6 months or a year. And if that parole conditions were she was allowed to have all the passwords of any device he had at home, or his mobile phone, she was always allowed to ask him exactly why he was late home from work, to check, you know, wherever he went. Those were the conditions of the parole. Or probation, what would you call it? Probation or parole? I don't know. Probation. Okay, on probation. And if he fulfills, I think they decided on 12 months of probation, then she would forgive him. He had to prove that he was trustworthy. Now, of course, any of you who have been cheated in a relationship, you know, just forgiving is sometimes not enough. They got to earn their trust back again. So he did that. 12 months he was put on probation. He behaved. She could check everything, allowed to ask any questions. And he had to answer truthfully. One mistake, and that would be it. The relationship was over. He won her back. And the nice thing for me and all the monks of Bodhinyana Monastery, the couple comes there every week out of gratitude. They got their relationship back together again. They loved each other before. There was still enough there to build up that relationship, and especially that trust. So that's one thing, if any of you face a situation like that. Forgiveness, but you've got to have that trust, to be able to build up that trust with a period of probation, 1 year, or 6 months, or whatever. If you behave, fine. Imagine if, you know, your partner refuses to give you a chance, then that is also a sense of distrust. So I kind of like that idea, giving people probation.